The previous episode of Church History here on the Enduring Word Channel looked at Christianity's arrival in Britain. We saw how the Anglo-Saxons pressed in from the east where they had been confined by what remained of the Roman army. But when the Romans pulled out in 410, the Saxons quickly moved in to take their place, confining the remaining Romano-British Christians to the western region of the island. And it was from that shrinking enclave of faith that a spark of faith leapt the Irish Sea to land in the dry tinder of Celtic Ireland. That spark's name was Patrick. While there are many legends surrounding Patrick's life, there's scant hard historical evidence for the details of his story. We have little idea when or where he was born, where he lived and worked, when and where he died, and other important specifics of his life. What we do have are incidental clues and some of his own records, vague as they are. The record of Christianity in Ireland prior to Patrick is sketchy. A bishop named Palladius was appointed by Pope Celestine to the island, but he didn't stay long. He left the same year, in fact, that Patrick arrived. Patricius, as his Latin name would have been pronounced, was born to an affluent and religious home. His birth name was Maewan Sukat. His father, Calpurnius, was a deacon. His grandfather, Porcius, a priest. Now, the family was likely of the Romano-British nobility and owned minor lands along the shores of Western Britain. Several locations claim to be Patrick's ancestral home. At the age of 16, he was captured by Irish slavers who regularly raided Britain's coast. He was taken back to Ireland and sold into captivity. Now, Patrick recounts little of his 6 years as a slave, except to say that he was a shepherd or swineherd who spent long periods tending his charges all alone. He endured long periods of hunger, thirst, and isolation. And that moved him to begin to seek God in earnest. The faith of his parents became his own. Years later, in writing what is known as his Confessio, Patrick said that he believed that his slavery was discipline for his, to that point, spiritual apathy. Not only did he attribute his slavery as the chastening of the Lord, he said that thousands of his fellow Britons also suffered for the very same reason. He came to see the discipline as God's grace because it, well, led him to Christ. He wrote, quote, "More and more the love of God and the fear of him grew in me, and my faith was increased and my spirit enlivened, so much that I prayed up to 100 times in the day and almost as often at night. I even remained in the wood and on the mountain to pray. And come hail, rain, or snow, I was up before dawn to pray, and I sensed no evil nor spiritual laziness within," unquote. At the age of 22, Patrick said that he heard a supernatural voice calling him to fast in preparation for returning to his home. And not long after, the voice spoke again, saying, quote, "Behold, your ship is prepared," unquote. The problem was, Patrick was 200 miles from the sea. Confident that he was following the direction of God, he struck out for the coast. When he arrived and informed the captain that he was supposed to board, the captain recognized him as a runaway slave and refused. Patrick realized now that his situation was precarious, and he looked for a place to hide. Seeing a nearby hut, he began to make his way there when one of the ship's crew shouted at him to hurry up and board. It seems that the crew was shorthanded and thought to use Patrick as a novice seaman, paying for his fare by the hard work of a lowly deckhand. Well, the ship set sail and 3 days later landed. Where that was is a mystery, as Patrick is vague at this point in his recounting of his story. Now, the best guess was that they had landed in northern Gaul, modern France. He says that once they landed, the crew wandered in a kind of wilderness for nearly a month. Now, we do know that between 407 and 410, the Goths and the Vandals ran amok across this region. Things grew desperate, and the captain began to berate Patrick, mocking his trust in an all-powerful, all-loving God. Where was all that power and that love now that they were in danger of starving to death? Patrick wasn't intimidated by the challenge. As we'll see, this kind of opportunity called forth from Patrick an even more determined faith. He told the captain, quote, "Nothing is impossible for God. Turn to him and he will send us food for our journey," unquote. Now, in desperation, the crew, they followed his counsel. And as they prayed, a herd of pigs suddenly appeared. The sailors feasted and thanked Patrick, but they balked at embracing his faith in God. Now, there's a break in Patrick's account at this point, so we're not sure what happened next. A couple of years pass, and he's back home in Britain with his family, where he studies to become a priest, and adopts the name Patricius, meaning father. Now, Patrick's family sensed that his days with them were closing out, and so they pleaded with him to stay, but he had learned enough of the will of God to know not to make such promises. A short time later, he heard the call back to Ireland. He says that he had a visionary dream in which an Irishman invited him back to the land of his slavery. Patrick writes in his Confessio, quote, "His name was Victoritius, and he carried countless letters, one of which he handed over to me. I read aloud where it began, 'The Voice of the Irish.' And as I began to read these words, it seemed to hear the voice of the same men who lived beside the forest of Focal, which lies near the western sea where the sun sets. They seemed to shout aloud to me as with one and the same voice, 'Holy boy, we beg you, come back and walk once more among us.' It was utterly pierced my heart's core so that I could read no more," unquote. Well, realizing that God was calling him back to the Green Isle, Patrick began to prepare. He understood the call to evangelize the Irish, but he didn't think himself properly equipped to do so. And so he sought training in the form of theological study and official ordination. Since both his father and grandfather had followed this course, it seemed proper for him as well. Now, there's some confusion at this point on where Patrick went to get his education. One biographer sends him to Rome, while others say that he went to Northern Gaul to study under Bishop Germanus. How long Patrick spent in training is unknown, but he was eventually ordained as a bishop. One notable event from this time that would later be important to his life was his confession of a youthful sin to a close friend. It was something that Patrick had done about a year before the Irish raiders had captured him. It troubled him ever after and moved him to confess to a friend in Gaul. That friend told him that he thought that it wasn't really all that important an issue to fret over and that it would not prohibit him from being used by God. The friend assured Patrick that he could and would be used by the Lord. Though the sin is left unspecified to us, it would later come back to haunt him. Patrick returned to Ireland around the year 432. How he evangelized Ireland is an important case study because it opens to us the mind of Christian missionaries during this period. It may also help us understand the troubling, well, religious syncretism that infected so much of the medieval church. Now, I just used a word there that may be unfamiliar to some, so I want to define it because it's going to be an important term in future episodes. In simplest terms, syncretism is a merging, it's a blending of two or more things. Religious syncretism is when a religion adopts beliefs and forms of other religions or ideologies. Instead of coming into Irish society with a brand new, utterly foreign religion, Patrick made a valiant effort to differentiate between aspects of traditional Irish religion and the gospel. He was accommodating of things that he did not regard as contrary to the gospel, so much so that Celtic Christianity he helped shape stood apart in many ways from that which dominated the continent. The native Celtic religion of Ireland, when Patrick returned, it was dominated by a pagan priesthood called the Druids. What we know of this Celtic religion is sketchy at best. Julius Caesar is one of our main sources from his encounters with them in his conquests of Gaul and Britain. The Romans loathed and at times feared the Druids. This was due to their near complete control over their people, a control enforced by abject terror. That terror may very well have been put in place by their being empowered by demonic spirits. Human sacrifice was a regular feature of the Druidic system, and they were attributed with the power to work the miraculous, and often in the cruelest fashion. Now, as I mentioned, there was some limited Christian presence in Ireland prior to Patrick's arrival, but the church had made little headway against the domination by the Druids. Patrick's six-year foray as a slave prepared him to know what he faced in the way of religious opposition when he returned. His plan was to confront the Druids on their own turf. He understood the only way to make headway among the people was by freeing them from their fear of the Druids. And to do that, he needed to look to the power of God to trump any demonstrations of demonic power that the Druids might conjure up. And this is where the stories of Patrick's life become, well, difficult to discern the truth of. His medieval biographers take this kernel of truth and they spin elaborate yarns about his confrontations with the Druids. And most of those stories are probably fictional, while a few may be based on real events. The larger lesson for us to glean is Patrick's method of evangelism. The idea had grown among theologians that pagan religions weren't so much anti-Christian as they were pre-Christian. Drawing from the Apostle Paul in Romans chapter 1, verse 20, they believed that, quote, since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes were clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, unquote. Paul himself applied this in the city of Athens when he spoke to the philosophers on Mars Hill. Paul was disturbed by the many idols that he encountered in the city of Athens, and yet he used them to evangelize the Athenians. He said, quote, I see how ultra-religious you are in every way. I even found an altar with the inscription to an unknown god. What you worship as unknown, I am here to make known to you, unquote. In Ecclesiastes, Solomon said that God has written eternity on people's hearts. Well, Patrick and those who followed after him looked for how to bring the truth of Christ to the lost by using whatever elements of their native faith that they could, converting it to the fuller truth of Christ. Well, Patrick and his contemporaries in no way approved of paganism or considered it an acceptable variant of the gospel. They believed that there were supernatural beings behind the idols and the ideals of paganism, demons who kept people in spiritual bondage. They believed that miracles and magic did occur. After all, Pharaoh's magicians had used supernatural power, but, and here's the key to Patrick's methodology, the God of Moses was more powerful and used his power to bring good, while demonic power served only to promote ruin and deceit. So, when Patrick arrived in Ireland and proclaimed the gospel, well, the Druids came out in opposition. Their hegemony over the Irish was being imperiled by him. They thought nothing of moving swiftly to kill him. They were the law. They could do whatever they wished, they thought. But they found offing Patrick harder than they at first assumed. None of their plans or their plots worked. It was as if a supernatural wall was protecting Patrick. He wrote of this time, quote, daily I expect murder, fraud, or captivity. But I fear none of these things because of the promises of heaven. I have cast myself into the hands of God Almighty who rules everywhere, unquote. Well, while trusting himself to the protection of God, he also took practical measures to gain allies among the Irish by building amicable relationships with them, especially some of their leaders. These allies kept him informed of the various plots against him. While Patrick does not himself record any specific confrontation with the Druids, well, that's the subject of many of his biographers. A turning point in Patrick's mission came when an Irish chieftain named Lochair came to faith. Now, this chieftain had a group of powerful Druids who advised him, but who were unable to defeat Patrick in demonstrations of supernatural power. When a couple of those Druids fell ill, Lochair was convinced of the superiority of Patrick's God and message, and so he professed faith in Christ. As was common to that culture, with his conversion, the people of his clan also came to faith. Their alliance with other clans opened the door for Patrick to bring the gospel to them as well, and soon the entire region had converted. This, then, was Patrick's method of evangelism as he made his way across Ireland. He confronted the Druids head-on, showing the superiority of God's power, breaking their monopoly on the minds of the Irish first, and then going after their hearts with the grace of God in the gospel of Christ. Another turning point was the conversion of some of the Druids themselves. Patrick was driven to bring the gospel to Ireland because Hibernia, as Ireland was called, was considered the end of the world. And Jesus had said that the gospel would be preached to the ends of the world, and then the end would come. Patrick thought that he was hastening Christ's return. In his writings, he repeatedly mentions that he was in the last days, and he quoted Matthew chapter 24, verse 14. He wrote, quote, it has been fulfilled. Behold, we are witnesses to the fact that the gospel has been preached out to beyond where anyone lives, unquote. Patrick wasn't alone in that belief. Christians never gave up the idea that Christ would return when all of the nations had heard about him. They just kept discovering more nations. About exactly 1,000 years after Patrick, Columbus went to America, not merely in a quest for fame and riches, but to hasten the second coming. His Book of Prophecies shows how he thought his discoveries had fitted into the biblical predictions of the end times. While the legend of Patrick's use of a shamrock to explain the Trinity is interesting, there's no evidence for it. It wouldn't have been necessary because in the Celtic religion, the concept of a divine trinity was already in place. There's also no evidence to support the idea that Patrick drove all of the snakes out of Ireland. Truth be told, there'd never been any snakes in Ireland for centuries. The tale may have been a kind of metaphor for Patrick's defeat of the Druids and their serpentine ways. You know, we've quoted the first of the two documents that Patrick left us, his confessio. The other was a letter that he wrote to a British chieftain named Caroticus. Now, Caroticus claimed to be a Christian, but he had sent his soldiers on raids to Ireland, and they had taken many of Patrick's converts as slaves. In fact, in one case, just a day after being baptized, dozens of Patrick's converts were brutally attacked by Caroticus's raiders. Though still dressed in their baptismal garments, many of them were killed, the rest hauled off as slaves. Well, Patrick was outraged and wrote an open letter to Caroticus, which he circulated to many others. It excommunicated both Caroticus and his soldiers, barring them from Christian fellowship and communion until they did penance and restored what they had stolen. That letter was one of the earliest Christian protests against slavery. Not long after Patrick was named bishop of the Irish Church, that friend to whom he had confessed his youthful sin betrayed him. Though the man had earlier said that what Patrick had done was no great error, well, he decided to brand it so by making it public and bringing shame on Patrick. Though we never do discover the nature of the thing, it was a scandal to church officials. Some called for Patrick's immediate ouster as bishop. Misfortune is a magnet of ill news, and soon others were adding to the accusations against him. One man even claimed that Patrick had gone to Ireland merely to get rich, which is kind of an odd charge when we consider the poverty that marked his life and the unlikely prospect before he went of the success of that ambition. That would be like, because I buy a basketball, someone claim I want to play in the NBA. That's never going to happen. But the charges were serious enough to require a church synod. An investigation was commissioned. A group went from Britain to Ireland to question Patrick. And though he never testified at the synod back in Britain, the turncoat friend who had betrayed him thought better of his betrayal and ended up defending him. The confessio was Patrick's reply to the charges against him. While the official outcome of the synod is unknown, that Patrick was never censured or deposed from his bishopric means that the charges had been dropped. This wasn't the only controversy that Patrick faced. He faced fierce opposition from critics who envied his success. One time he baptized many hundreds of people. Some of them gave him a gift of appreciation for his work. Unable to find anything of substance to accuse Patrick of, envious bishops expressed their, well, dismay that Patrick would accept such gifts. His response was, in effect, "What gifts?" Because he had given them all away, mostly to the poor. Patrick was less concerned with planting churches as he was in making converts, and he was tireless in his journeys back and forth across Ireland to that end. Following the pattern of the time, he considered the ascetic life of the monastery as the purest form of the faith, and so encouraged his converts to be monks and nuns. This led to the building of dozens of monasteries and convents in Ireland. The rural nature of Ireland encouraged this form of the church. Without major urban centers, large churches overseen by bishops were rare, and so Irish Christianity was centered in communal monastic life. Though precise dating for Patrick's life is debated, the general consensus is that he died of natural causes on March 17th of 493. Today, he's one of the most famous figures of the 5th century. Like so many others of the past who accomplished great things, we'd probably not even know of him were it not for the dynamic missions outreach that came from Ireland. Patrick, patron saint of Ireland, was British, and the faith that he transplanted across the Irish Sea eventually came back to Britain. Many have noted how the Irish have a habit of leaving Ireland, and the missionary monks were no exception. There were churches in Britain before Patrick's day. His father and grandfather were church leaders. But the Anglo-Saxons had confined Christian Britain to a small sliver of the West. A century after Patrick, an Irish monk named Columba founded a monastery on the island of Iona off the coast of Scotland. Though a small base, Iona was nevertheless responsible for a mighty wave of missionary outreach to Scotland and Britain. With this vibrant base in Ireland and Britain, Celtic monks went to the continent, to Europe. They established bases of outreach in Germany, Switzerland, and Italy. These, in turn, became centers of evangelization and scholarship. These Celtic monasteries maintained fierce independence from Rome, though they held the same faith. The Roman popes tried to assert authority over them, but for the most part, Celtic Christianity resisted Rome's attempts to rein them in. It was in these monasteries that much of the ancient wisdom of the Greeks and the Romans was stored. It was laboriously copied and assiduously studied, waiting for the day that it would emerge in the Renaissance. In his book, How the Irish Saved Civilization, Thomas Cahill says this of Patrick, quote, "The Irish gave Patrick more than a home. They gave him a role, a meaning to his life. For only this former slave had the right instincts to impart to the Irish a new story, one that made new sense of all their old stories and brought them a peace that they had never known before." Unquote. What's unique to Patrick is the close connection that the Irish have to their patron saint. There have been many so-called saints in church history. Few have been so highly regarded and figured so prominently in later generations than Patrick. Wherever the Irish have gone in their wanderings and resettlement in new lands, they've renewed their connection to Patrick in the naming of their sons and churches.